Good evening, and this is a very exciting call-in for us tonight. We have Dr. Gerald Kreisman, who wrote I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, which is probably the landmark book, one of its first of its kind, written on borderline personality disorder in 1989, and then a second edition that came out, I think, about 2 years ago. I'm going to turn over the mic to Dr. Kreisman, and he's going to give you a full information about himself. But he is one of the early people who has really helped to put this disorder on the map. Dr. Kreisman, thank you so much for joining us, and it's our pleasure to spend this hour with you.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's great to be with you, and it's a privilege to be with the NEBPD group and those of you here tonight. My name is Jerry Kreisman. I'm a psychiatrist in St. Louis. We had written some works together back some years ago, the I Hate You, Don't Leave Me book, and about 5 or 6 years ago, we did a follow-up that looked more at some other perspectives of it called Sometimes I Get Crazy. We developed a borderline unit at a hospital here in St. Louis, and that's where I am now. What I was hoping would be of interest to the group tonight would be to kind of review tonight some of the changes that have occurred over these last many years in how we conceive of the whole disorder of borderline personality, how we've come to change our definition of it, how we differentiate it from other disorders, and in particular, over these last 15 years, the significant changes that have occurred in our understanding of this disorder, particularly involving our understanding of the progress that people make, the outcome of individuals who have this diagnosis, as well as the development of very specific treatment programs for it. Our whole concept of borderline personality has really changed over the last more than 100 years. Going back all the way to Sigmund Freud, some of his early cases that he designated hysteria would probably today be diagnosed as borderline personality, his very descriptive cases that he published of Anna O and the Wolfman and the Ratman and all of those. Going into the 20s, Reich developed what he called the impulsive character that was characterized by changes of impulsivity and a tendency to see things in extremes of black or white. And he first talked about the concept of splitting that we see so much, the tendency to see opposites and for things to be very, very good or very, very bad. It wasn't until the 30s that Stern developed the term of what he called borderline personality. And he developed this as a group of patients that he saw that seemed to be in between what then was characterized as neurosis versus psychosis. Neurosis being people who had gentler disorders of depression or anxiety and who were good candidates for psychoanalysis versus individuals who had lost touch with reality. And this sort of in-between group of patients appeared to be, on the surface, very high-functioning and in that neurotic classification. But under the kind of sensory deprivation that goes on in psychoanalysis and such, these people could really unravel, and so they seem to be on the border between them. In the 40s and 50s, what was conceived of as borderline personality seemed to be more associated with the schizophrenia spectrum. And people, many of the writers at that time referred to this cadre of individuals that we now call borderline personality with such phrases as ambulatory schizophrenia or pre-schizophrenia or pseudo-neurotic schizophrenia. Deutsch coined what she termed the as-if personality and brought attention to how individuals with BPD can be very chameleon-like, can change their personalities as if they were somebody else, but also reflecting a lack of self-identity that is stable. In the 50s, Knight talked about borderline states and kind of resurrected the whole idea of borderline personality. But it was still something that was seen as something closer to schizophrenia. And in the DSM-2, the second iteration of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that clinicians look at, which was published in 1968, the borderline diagnosis was under the rubric of latent schizophrenia. It was also around this time in the late 60s that Kernberg developed what he called borderline personality organization. And that subsumed a whole great group of individuals of not only what today would be called borderline personality, but many of the other personality disorders and elements of depression. The real landmark of how we try to understand, how we try to conceive of what this diagnosis means of BPD really came in 1975 when Gunderson and Singer first described what they termed borderline personality disorder and listed a number of criteria. On a personal note, I remember very, very clearly when this was when this article was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry in January 1975. I was just starting my psychiatry training at that time. And I was seeing this group of patients that we called depressed or anxious, but we just didn't understand them very well, and they had other kinds of issues that just were not the usual run-of-the-mill, particularly difficulties with some of the impulsivity and some of the tremendous mood instability. And this this description really resonated, I think, with beginning to lasso in this group of patients we just didn't know what to do with. Actually, that particular journal was especially important for me because Gunderson and Singer's article was the very first article in that edition, and the first published article I ever wrote was the last article in that edition that was on Kudurismo and the integration of folk and cultural psychiatry with more traditional psychiatry, which I guess is still something significant today. Also around that time in the late 70s, other physicians, non-psychiatry physicians, were also beginning to see a very difficult group of patients. Some were clinging, demanding, litigious, and difficult to deal with. And Gross published an article in the very well-known journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, that was directed most towards general physicians. In an article he called The Hateful Patient. And here, although he didn't use the word borderline, he was talking about many of the characteristics that made such individuals very difficult to deal with among different professionals. Finally, in 1980, the DSM-3 first concretized the whole concept of borderline personality. Interestingly, they pretty much adopted the description from Gunderson and Singer. With one exception, they left out one of the criteria that Gunderson and Singer had described in 75, and that was the prevalence of brief psychotic episodes. And interestingly, in DSM-4, some 10 or so years later, that criterion was put back in when more data was seen, and it was seen to be a sometimes defining criterion for this. But still, research around this time still tended to stay with seeing this as something closer to schizophrenia, and a lot of articles were shown to try to differentiate this from schizophrenia. Well, here we are today with DSM-4, and we're on the precipice of changes of how we define this because the fifth iteration, DSM-5, is to be released next May. And by the way, DSM-5, unlike the previous DSMs, will be the 5 is the numerical 5, not the Roman numeral 5. So we won't have Super Bowl confusion anymore. They did that because future revisions of the DSM-5 will be seen as DSM-5.2 or DSM-5.3. So we won't be dealing with Roman numerals starting next year. In any event, DSM-4, there will be significant changes with this fifth iteration. And if you take a look on the second slide, it sort of tells us where we are now with DSM-4 and how borderline personality slips into the description of the 9 other personality disorders. DSM-5 at this point has suggested that there will be elimination of 4 of these 10 personality disorders, so that next year, paranoid, schizotypal, histrionic, dependent personality, all of those apparently are going to be eliminated. And so we'll just have left the ones that are still there, schizotypal, antisocial, borderline, avoidant, obsessive, compulsive, and narcissistic. By the way, the original proposal was also to eliminate narcissistic personality disorder as one of the formal personality disorders. But a great hue and cry arose, and the International Brotherhood of Narcissists everywhere raised quite an objection. Even though there wasn't a lot of data to define exactly what narcissistic personality disorder, it was decided it was a syndrome in which, well, you know it when you see it. And so it was left, at least at this point, it looks like that will be left in as one of the other personality disorders. Now, currently, DSM-4 defines borderline personality through these 9 characteristics. And again, these are adapted almost completely directly from the original Dunderson-Singer article some 27 years ago. And I've just, in a random kind of way, just grouped them. It helps me kind of remember them a little bit easier. Under these headings, the mood instability, subsuming 4 of the characteristics, and then the behavioral discontrol, describing the impulsivity and rage outbursts, and so on, as you have on your paper there. Officially, this is what's called a categorical definition. There are 9 symptoms, and in order to fulfill the diagnosis, one must have 5 of these 9. The problem with this, of course, is that if suddenly one goes from 5 of the 9 to 4 of the 9, the diagnosis disappears. And many people understand that since personality is usually thought to be something more of a trait, something that stays with an individual more, the idea it could overnight just disappear has led proposals for the DSM-5 next year to include what's referred to as a dimensional definition along with the categorical. In other words, what will hopefully attempt to be shown will be a borderline-ishness, just how borderline is the person. And one of the proposals will be for all of these personality disorders to have kind of a stereotype described, and then how close one matches that stereotype from, say, a scale of 1 to 5. So that's what's in store for us. And that's how. And this is kind of a review of how mental health professionals have looked at borderline personality. But I think the more cogent, colorful, and probably more accurate descriptions are what our patients tell us, what individuals who are dealing with BPD tell us. And in the 4th slide is just one of the quotes of someone who tried to articulate what they were feeling. And this metaphor of having a monster inside is something I've heard a lot of over the years, a sense of being taken over with rage or impulsivity or self-destructiveness. And for some of these individuals whose way of describing it can be in a more artistic kind of way, I just added in the handout some of the paintings and drawings that individuals have used to attempt to describe what they're going through. And in the 5th slide, I think is one explication of what it feels like to not have a real sense of one's personal identity. And in the slide after that is an example of the split that some of the individuals have felt. On the upper part, that sense of just chaos, split off from sunshine and rainbows and such. The next slide, I think, shows some of the self-destructive behaviors that are there, with these drops of blood intermingling with the words death and suicide and overdose and slash wrists and so forth. many of these are very meticulously drawn. In some cases, a real obsessive feeling about how it can affect an individual. And the last one, I guess, is just kind of an overall example of the loneliness, rejection, frustration, and sadness and anger that many of these individuals feel, the sense of a bomb that's about to go off, and particularly the sense of isolation. So many individuals who struggle with BPD, and the people who care for them and try to work with them so often can feel kind of cut off from the rest of other individuals. In the ninth slide, I kind of asked a question that I think has troubled me, and one of the things that really hasn't changed very much over these last 20 years, when so much more information has been developed in regard to BPD. We know that in some studies, anywhere from 10 to 25% of individuals who are in active treatment in an outpatient setting with therapists or an inpatient setting in a psychiatric unit will satisfy the criteria for borderline personality and yet frequently don't have the diagnosis. Some of this, I think, is for misdiagnosis. Some individuals, unless a very careful history is taken, can describe such things as mood swings or destructive behavior, and it can be mistaken for something else, such as bipolar disorder. Or it can also, BPD usually does coexist with other illnesses, and these can kind of mask the underlying BPD that accompanies the disorder. If there's prominence of major depression or substance abuse, sometimes the recognition of the underlying BPD gets missed from recognition. I think there's still, unfortunately, still a stigma. Another area that has not changed very much, I don't think, over the 20 years. You certainly hear about much more in the media, on TV and magazines and movies, about people who are ill, and when they're acting up, they'll be labeled borderline. And certainly it seems to be a less desirable diagnosis, especially if you live in Southern California, get stopped for a DUI, you tell your manager you're bipolar, go into rehab, and you're fixed in a couple of weeks. It seems like other diagnoses are more acceptable than that of borderline. There's also been a bias against any of these what are called Axis 2, which are sort of secondary diagnoses of the personality disorders. And so I think insurance has had a negative effect. And this, by the way, is one of the changes that also is projected for the DSM-5, and that is to transpose personality disorders from what seems like a secondary axis, what they call Axis 2, and to place the personality disorders, including BPD, on Axis 1, which is essentially the area of definitions that subsume all of the other psychiatric diagnoses. So rather than a secondary diagnosis, it will be basically in the same league as all of the other psychiatric diagnoses. And this may make it a little bit more acceptable for insurance to recognize and be able to cover. And finally, there still remains a bias. Unfortunately, I think many people label individuals who are a pain in the neck, who they don't like. And I think professionals do this a fair amount, too. To label them a dirty, no good borderline, because it does seem to be associated with an unlikable person, or, again, like the hateful patient. One of the difficulties that happens with BPD, I think, is in differentiating it from other disorders, and that also is where there's a lot of confusion. And in the next slide, I kind of put up some of the major criteria that define BPD and compared it to a couple of other diagnoses that I think frequently get confused with it, although they may accompany them. PPD, of course, is characterized by impulsivity and mood instability, rage outbursts, interpersonal conflicts, drug abuse, self-destructive behavior, possibly transient psychotic behavior, and it's also kind of continuous and ongoing. It's not something that just disappears. But it can be understood to be differentiated from some of these other things by the age that it appears and just playing the odds. PPD is generally felt to be around 6% of the population. Bipolar disorder is thought to be around 2% of the population. Attention deficit disorder is probably the most common, appearing in perhaps 8% of the population or more. Usually, characteristics of borderline personality emerge in adolescence or early 20s, whereas the usual symptomatology of classic bipolar disorder becomes recognizable usually later on in the middle, late 20s, and even early 30s. The symptomatology of attention deficit disorder often and usually is recognized in childhood. And though all three may exhibit characteristics of impulsivity and mood instability, people with bipolar disorder tend not to have so much of the conflicts with others that you see with ADD and BPD, nor is it this more continuous kind of behavior. Classical bipolar disorder is alternating periods of mania intermixed with alternating periods of depression, more often mixed with in-between periods of stable moods. So there's a real lability and changeability there that, whereas in ADD and BPD, you see a more ongoing expression of symptoms. By the same token, there may be a psychotic episode or self-destructive episode in individuals with BPD and bipolar disorder, but less likely to see that in attention deficit disorder. And when you look at some of the other diagnoses that perhaps can also be confused, again, looking at substance abuse disorder, which often accompanies BPD, or what's called intermittent explosive disorder, or even schizophrenia, which are those diagnoses on the bottom. Again, you can see there are certainly common characteristics, but again, some differences there. I think perhaps one of the two biggest changes that really have altered in the last 20 years is our understanding of the outcome of individuals with BPD. Certainly until perhaps the last 10 or 15 years, this was a disorder that was thought to be ingrained in personality, never got better, was a rather discouraging syndrome to attempt to deal with, not only with professionals, but also with those people, family members and loved ones. And it was something that just didn't get better and you just had to put up with. And long-term studies show clearly that's not the case, that the vast majority of these individuals do get better over time. And in fact, in the long-term studies going 15, 16 years, almost all of them have periods of significant improvement. And by remission, what I mean is they no longer satisfy those five necessary of the nine defining criteria. And this recovery that can happen, although it may take longer, occurs even in individuals who never do seek treatment. There is some downsides, however, to the outcome. We do know that people who have sustained recovery and are doing really quite well still may have some relapses over time, about 1 out of 10. And ultimately, although they may no longer satisfy the current definition of BPD, many of these individuals continue to have struggles most prominently in occupational areas and social areas. All of this, of course, is mitigated by a suicide rate that can be as high as 10%. Now, there are a number of positive and negative prognostic indicators that have an impact on how well individuals do. And again, let me say that many of us in this profession have worked with individuals who have gone on to be very successful and to do very well in all of these areas. And those individuals that do tend to do better generally express some of the factors that I've outlined in the 13th slide here. These are individuals with good self-discipline, likableness. These are usually attractive people who are easily can engender supportive relationships and usually have a degree of intelligence that allows a certain amount of insight and motivation to change behavior. The next slide reflects some of the negative factors that make it a bit more difficult and may have sustained a negative impact on those individuals. And that is persistence of the hostility, a history of a difficult upbringing over the years, significant problems with other psychiatric or medical disorders such as substance abuse or a pernicious depression, and particularly antisocial characteristics. The other major change in our understanding over the last 15 years has been in the treatment. We now have specific treatments that have developed over this time that really help us understand more what these individuals are going through and also how to help them. Now, certainly a discussion of treatment some 20 years ago or so would have been something like this. Well, you take these individuals and you have them undergo very intensive long-term individual therapy. If they're a little depressed, try an antidepressant. That's it. Lecture's over. Let's eat. Now we know that much more can be done. The cornerstone of treatment remains and has always been psychotherapy, but there have been some use of medications that have been helpful, and many have been used over the times, and that's in this next, the 16th slide. And I listed just a whole bunch of treatment approaches that have been documented over the last 20 or 30 years. Everything from use not only of antidepressants, but shock treatment, estrogen treatment, DOPA, and medicines that are used for hypertension, such as beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, thyroid treatment, and most of them have been directed at specific kind of symptoms that are reflected in BPD, such as mood instability or impulsivity, and so forth. Some have been somewhat successful, such as the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Some have actually made some things worse. Tricyclic antidepressants have sometimes worsened impulsivity. These are the more the older antidepressants, such as Elavil and Tofranil from years ago. Some of the benzodiazepine group medicines, such as Valium and Xanax, also have been shown to sometimes worsen impulsivity. So over the years, we've begun to get a feel for what seems to work in terms of medicines and what seems not to work, or at least not as well. Now, in 2001, the American Psychiatric Association came out with what they call the APA guidelines for the treatment of BPD. And again, they reiterated that psychotherapy is the cornerstone, although at that time there weren't any specific psychotherapy approaches other than just trying to do good psychiatric or psychological mental health treatment. On the 17th slide, on the next one, though, they did collate the various studies that were done with medications and attempted to collate some of this and make some recommendations looking at the specific kind of more prominent demonstrations in the individual with BPD. And so they sort of split up the more prominent exhibitions of symptoms between these three, mood instability, impulsivity, and the cognitive perceptual dissociations that sometimes happen with brief psychotic episodes or dissociation. And so they recommended serotonin reuptake inhibitors, medicines such as Prozac, Zoloft, and such. And many of these studies showed that the doses had to be fairly high, and what was intriguing in these studies is although it would it would be expected that some of these antidepressant medicines might help the mood difficulties, it seems that many of these also seem to help the impulse control. Oftentimes in very high doses, doses that were much higher than usually used in the treatment for depression. Also interestingly, they found, particularly in those individuals who express more prominent elements of impulse discontrol, that an antipsychotic type medicine, these would be medicines like Risperdal, Zyprexa, Haldol, and Nabane, and some of the newer ones, that these seem to help not only the impulse control, but also help the mood instability. And sometimes combinations were very helpful. Interestingly, the doses of these antipsychotic medicines were usually extremely low, much lower than when they were used for treating more seriously psychotic behaviors. They also found that sometimes mood stabilizers, and these are basically medicines used to treat seizure disorders, were also helpful for some of these as an addition. And these are medicines like Depakote, Tegretol, Lamictal, and so on. One of the hazards of these guidelines, though, I think, and what has developed and changed a bit, is in the absence, until relatively recently, of really refined psychotherapy treatment approaches, I think there was a tendency to medicate a great deal. And I think a general opinion now is that is the observation that many, many individuals with this diagnosis of BPD may be treated with a whole bunch of medicines, and oftentimes are maybe on 4, 5, 6 medicines. And there's now becoming more of a question of how helpful they are with medicines, and that, again, the return to looking at the psychotherapy techniques is perhaps a better approach in trying to redefine the efficacy of the medicines, which undoubtedly can be helpful, but sometimes there's a growing feeling that they may be overused in individuals. In the next slide, the 18th slide, I kind of listed the most prominent psychotherapy techniques that have elicited the most data, the most information in specific techniques. Most of these are manualized, which means that individuals who practice these psychotherapy techniques usually undergo a specific kind of training and follow a kind of manual that recommends a certain step-by-step approach in the treatment. And these have been focused specifically on BPD and have developed most particularly over the last 15 years or so. I think at the top, dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, is certainly the one that is the oldest around and has had the most information published about it and studies done with it. And this is a treatment approach that sort of combines very cognitive behavioral changes. There's less interest in going into background. The main goal is what cognitive therapy tends to do, which is to deal with behavior. The end point is changing destructive behavior. And it combines that with kind of a Zen attitude. And one of the dialectics, which refers to kind of a paradox in this, is the attempt to express to the individual a recognition that they need to accept who they are and accept where they are at the moment and simultaneously push themselves to try harder. So you're both encouraging the individual to be self-accepting of where he or she is now, but also encouraging them to do more. And this therapy usually involves weekly individual therapy, which is essentially reinforcing the learning that's going on during the treatment. Weekly group therapy, which involves educating about the disorder and ways of dealing with it and developing skills on how to deal with it. Phone contacts are available, and this is the only treatment approach that actually endorses that as a primary part of the treatment. And another part that is kind of unique for DBT is the mandating of all of the therapists involved with the particular individual to meet together in their own meetings. The second approach there, the STEPS approach, is really kind of a outgrowth of DBT that was directed more as a less intensive, less expensive treatment approach. Adopts many of the characteristics of DBT, but is usually shorter in time and works primarily in the group therapy rather than the emphasis on the individual therapy. Schema-focused therapy is now we're moving away from some of the sort of cognitive behavioral approaches and more into some of the psychodynamic, where there is more of an interest in the development of the disorder, how it came to be. And in SFT, schema-focused therapy, treatment is usually individually every week, and the focus is on what are felt to be maladaptive schemas, that is, maladaptive ways of looking at oneself and the world that develop from distorted childhood upbringing and experience in the individual's life. And the treatment is an attempt to recognize these in specific kind of schemas are defined and described, and then attempted to alter these. Mentalization-based therapy is developed mostly in England, and this is an area, again, that's more psychodynamic, where the emphasis is on the individual trying to get away from reflex reactions to situations, and instead being able to, what's called mentalize, think through and understand why they're feeling what they're feeling, why they're behaving in certain kinds of ways, many of which may be regretful. And also beginning to try to understand the people with whom they interact and what their motivations might be. And so the hope is to begin to understand more clearly why the individual is feeling what they're feeling and why they're behaving the way they're behaving and where it stems from as they attempt to make changes with it. This involves individual and group therapy on a regular basis. It was first developed in an intensive outpatient setting where contacts were held 5 days a week, but it can also and is adapted for more like a once-a-week program. Transference-focused therapy, developed by Kernberg, is a much more clearly psychoanalytic, psychodynamic process. Usually it's individual therapy meeting about twice a week. And here the focus is on the interpersonal, on the difficulty in functioning in the environment, the difficulty in interacting with other people. And emphasis is on the relationship with the therapist and beginning to see distortions developing with the therapist, what's referred to as transference, and then being able to generalize that to other relationships. And then finally, GPM, what's called general psychiatric management, or good psychiatric management, or actually you could call it Gunderson's psychiatric management since he described it first, which is essentially more of what in the past has been thought of as a kind of supportive therapy. It's usually individual treatment once a week. And basically, it's the attempt by the therapist to manage day-to-day problems, adjust medications if they're necessary, and be a supportive, constant, non-rejecting individual in this person's life. And so often that's what happens with individuals with BPD is they have such a difficulty having continuous and constant relationships that sometimes the longest-lasting relationship for many people who experience destructive behaviors is going to be the therapist who's there still consistent and reliable over periods of years. When you look at all of these, I think there are more commonalities than there are differences. They all deal with or address self-destructive behavior. All of these attempt to correct distorted views of oneself and others. All of them attempt to establish a supportive relationship with therapists, and also while challenging maladaptive behaviors in an attempt to help the individual adjust to the environment in which they live. So all of them attempt to combine a kind of supportive approach with also behavioral attempts to kind of understand what's happening and change behavior. And the last thing I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes, and then hopefully we'll be able to open things and see if there are questions or comments from this, is I thought I would describe a little bit about what we developed in St. Louis in our unit some 30 years ago that really predates these other programs. And that's the SEP system of communication. What we were doing here is not so much developing a treatment approach, but really something much more modest, kind of a communication system, an attempt to kind of figure out a way to communicate with not just people with BPD, but really others with whom there may be a fractious relationship with. And in this development of communications, we found that one would attempt in every individual communication to express three levels in it, and so that there would be three elements that would need to be communicated in every interaction. And these would be elements of support, empathy, and reality or truth. And so with every interaction, one would attempt to express all three elements of this triangle. A support statement is an I statement, a statement that basically says, I'm here to help you, I care about you, I want to support you. And again, not just thinking from the clinician standpoint, but also from a loved one or friend or neighbor or family member, basically expressing the commitment to want to try to be of help. The second communication is an empathy statement. That's kind of a you statement, an acknowledgement that the person with BPD is suffering, that this isn't a game, they're not having a lot of fun, that it's not jolly, that the situation they're in is painful and difficult for them, and we understand that. And then finally, the truth part that needs to be balanced directly with the other two elements is just the reality part that says, okay, here's the predicament, and now we have to determine what we're going to do about it. And what we found is that we could get clues when we're able to express all three. Communication seemed to work better when we balance this, but we could get clues to what element would be missing by how the individual would respond. And if a message, a retort that we would get would be along the lines of, well, you don't care about me. You're just doing this because you feel guilty. You're just doing this because you feel pressured. You're just doing this for the money. You're just doing this for something. You don't really care about me. Would usually indicate that the support side of the triangle is either not being expressed enough or it's just not being heard. And so one could redouble efforts to kind of, again, counter that by being able to express some of that. When the empathy message was missing, this was the response you got here on this next slide. You don't know how I feel. You can't understand me. How can you do? You don't know. You can't be of any help for me because you don't know what's going on with me. And of course, in a literal way, that's true. We can't get inside the other individual, but it does indicate person somehow isn't hearing some acknowledgement from the person trying to help, the loved one, family member, or professional, of some acknowledgement that we do understand that this is difficult, that this is painful. And if the last part's missing, the reality part, things can go deceptively swimmingly. Everything's going along fine. And partly because there's no challenge, partly because what becomes concretized is an idea of the other person is really going to rescue me, is going to take care of me, is going to make everything all right, with an avoidance of dealing with the reality issues. And that inevitably will lead to a grand conflagration when inevitably it must occur that there will be disappointment where the other person isn't going to be able to take care of you, isn't going to be able to make everything fine. So there can be some deception that will preface an explosion down the road if there isn't some reality injected. Support and empathy without truth, then, really is a postponement of an explosion later on. The last slides, though, sort of suggest what happens if you have just truth without any support and empathy, and you have kind of a distorted version of tough love, where all you're going to be talking about is the predicament, and that will lead inevitably to just rejection of any message that you might want to give. Well, that kind of summarizes some of the long-winded review of what I think has happened in conceiving of borderline personality over the years, how we define it, how we distinguish it from other disorders, and what is most exciting, the changes in our understanding of the reality that most of these people get better, and that we also have specific kind of treatment approaches that help, that can help them get better. So with all that, I think I'd like to shut up for a little while and see if there are any comments as we go along.
Well, thank you. I thought this was absolutely wonderful. What I think I'm going to do is, rather than wait for emails to come in, I'm going to unmute people. I'm going to ask people who would like to ask a question to please feel free to do so. Do not make a personal – well, let's not focus on personal questions, though, but more on the disorder and just general questions. So I'm going to unmute people, and let's see how that goes.
I have a question.
Yes.
So the question is, in coming from a DBT angle and working from that vantage point, truth, what we tell our people is there are many truths out there. So in terms of the, and I love seeing that triangle, but in terms of the truth, who determines the truth?
It was a little unclear. I think I heard the question. It sort of went in and out. And that is who determines the truth. I think that's a collaboration, and I think it usually I think the other person is going to have to sort of contribute a little bit more of it. I mean, obviously, if there's denial about the fact that gee, you just got picked up for a DUI and you're going to have to go to jail, obviously the other individual is going to have to bring that to the fore again, trying to balance it as much as possible. Ultimately, it has to be kind of an accepted collaboration. I think if that was the question, I hope that answered.
Yeah, and actually that makes sense.
Other question?
I have a question. In dealing with a family member, how concerned should we be about that 10% possibility of suicide?
I think it's obviously something to be concerned about. A lot of the suicides we speculate are unintentional. You know, a patient with BPD who may be cutting on himself. May hit an artery, may be doing it not to die, but to feel some of the pain that often happens as an expression of feeling with BPD. And they may hit an artery and die. Or they may have taken some extra pain medicine because they were feeling some pain and took more than they should have. So sometimes it's accidental. I think it is something that one has to take seriously. And I think a good way of approaching it, I found, is using some of these set principles that I was talking about, because you get sort of sometimes put in a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. In other words, the individual says, okay, I hate you, and I'm sorry, what?
I think that was someone in the background.
Okay. Can I continue?
Yes, please.
Okay. An individual says, I'm angry at you, and I'm going to overdose, and I took some pills. I think saying, well, I'm really concerned about you. And then the person will say something like, but don't call the police, and I'm not going to the hospital. If you do that, I'll hate you, and I'll never talk to you again, but I'm going to go kill myself. And so the individual is put in a no-win situation. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. And I think being able to express a sense of, well, I'm very concerned about you, and obviously you must be feeling terrible to be taking these pills and to feel like killing yourself. But the reality is whenever anybody says they're going to kill themselves, well, obviously you don't sit back and say, well, that's fine. I'm going to call an ambulance. I'll call 911, and we'll have you evaluated at the hospital, because that's the reality. That's what one has to do. And I know you'll be upset with me, but I certainly don't want you to die, and if you're telling me these things, then that's what we have to do.
There was a question that came in by email. What type of treatment is best for when someone is splitting?
When someone is what?
Splitting.
Listen to this one.
Uh-huh. You mean of these treatment approaches?
Yes, exactly.
Since that's a prominent part of BPD, all of these do make adaptations to that. When there are more therapists involved, for example, in DBT, you have an individual therapist and a group therapist, it is really easy to split and tell, you know, or someone who's seeing a psychiatrist for medicine and another therapist for therapy and complaining about one to the other. Any of these treatment approaches can be helpful, but the real important element of it all is communication. If there is split therapy between the group therapist and the individual therapist, or between the psychiatrist and the psychologist, there needs to be ongoing communication so that both are on the same page. Otherwise, it gets really easy to get pulled away from that. So I think that's the most important part. And I think also for family members and loved ones, to before you jump off on what's being said, to kind of take everything with a grain of salt and check things out before you start hearing about how evil some other, say, family member is and how wonderful you are. You want to be a little careful there and check those things out before you get caught up in it.
And you also, I think you mentioned something about some people being diagnosed with BPD but perhaps not having it. Did you say that?
Yeah.
Can you speak more about that?
Yeah, I think for the reasons I said before about why it's not diagnosed, because of stigma and I think confusion, I think a lot of times it gets particularly camouflaged. And sometimes when people say, well, I cut on my wrist, the automatic assumption is, well, you must be depressed. And so they receive a diagnosis of depression and are unable to look a little further and try to determine, well, why is that happening? And is it an attempt to feel? Is it an attempt to punish? Is it something that might be more suggestive of BPD rather than a mood disorder? Likewise, as I think I gave an example, somebody who abuses medicines or drugs might be... What's that?
The background noise again, sorry.
The focus may change. I mean, an example would be if an individual has a fight with their spouse and goes to the bar and drinks and then causes a commotion and jumps in the car and goes speeding. If that person's a woman, the police will probably take her to the emergency room and she'll get a diagnosis of depression or borderline personality. If that person is a male, police will probably take him to jail. And maybe somewhere down the road will get a diagnosis of alcoholism or antisocial personality, even though it's the same behavior. So there are these gender biases as well, I think, that sometimes obscure what we're seeing.
And in reverse, have you seen people being diagnosed with BPD who don't have it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that harks back to what I mentioned before, too, with some of the biases. I think sometimes it's a diagnosis of anger. When somebody annoys the mental health worker, they'll get that kind of diagnosis. I was just, and every once in a while, at least once every week or a couple of weeks, if I'm watching some TV show or a movie or something, there'll be if somebody's doing kind of disagreeable behavior or aggravating somebody, they'll sometimes say, well, I think he's depressed, I think he's borderline. So you kind of get a label when somebody's behavior is annoying sometimes that I think sometimes misses maybe something else. So I think it can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
And what, when you say, what, how would you define the difference between somebody being having borderline personality disorder or having borderline traits?
Well, the as we stand right now with the current definitions with DSM-4, one could say that one trait, if they didn't satisfy the 5 of the 9 criteria, in other words, someone who was struggling with relationships, tended to be somewhat self-destructive, maybe had some rage outbursts, but didn't satisfy any of the criteria, I think you could say, well, that person is exhibiting borderline traits. But they would have the formal diagnosis if they fulfilled at least 5 of the 9 criteria. And that may be something that changes with this more dimensional approach in DSM-5 that I alluded to before, that if the connection to the sort of stereotype description of BPD is sort of less than really high, they may be characterized as having borderline traits rather than the full-fledged disorder.
Any other questions?
I have a question. Yes. First of all, I have your book for many, many years. My daughter was in therapy and brought your book home years ago, it must have been 15 years ago, saying that my therapist says that you should read this book, that this is what you have. And I have it right here. And I have a few questions. And first of all, I'm enjoying Mr. Kreisman, the lecture this evening. My family member pulls her hair, a old trick or something, and I once read that having strep throats and very high fevers when she was very young did something to her brain to do that. Is there any connection to borderline, it developed into borderline personality? Is there any connection to high fevers doing something to the brain? And the other part, that's part one. The other question is, and it's very important for me to know, should we be talking to the family member about the fact that she has this disorder? We all skirt around it, and we never tell her that she has borderline personality. Thank you. I'll sit back and listen.
Well, there is some evidence that there is some organic disorders that some studies have indicated there are in some people with BPD that there are abnormal EEGs, and as you described, having some early childhood potential insult to the brain sometimes has been associated with elements of compulsive behavior or obsessive compulsive disorder, and the pulling of the hair, the trichotillomania, could be conceived of as kind of a type of obsessive compulsive disorder. So there really is some evidence. Some studies have shown certain other changes in the brain. I don't want to get too technical about this, but the way the right and the left side of the brain communicate with each other and other things, that it certainly is conceivable that there may be some difficult to detect organic insults to the brain early on that may predispose to this. I think in general, BPD is like just about all other medical illnesses. I think in general, there's probably some genetic predisposition, some possibility of inherited vulnerability that in combination with environmental issues can result in the disorder, whether it's BPD or myocardial infarction or hypertension or whatever. In terms of whether one should talk about the diagnosis, the trend in years past was not to do that. The trend now is very much to do that. Personally, I believe that it's really something you have to take individually. There's some people who wear any diagnosis, including BPD, as kind of a badge, and sometimes can use it as an excuse. They can read everything, and they can look into it, and they can really identify, well, I'm BPD, and that explains why this problem and that problem, and get all intellectual about it, but not really work with it. On the other hand, many people are just hungry for a diagnosis, and it can be really very reassuring to know that oh my gosh, there's a name for this, and I'm not alone, and other people experience what I experience. And this isn't some, I'm just not some crazy alien out there. You almost have to sort of judge it. I think the tendency, though, is to educate it, not to hammer it home. My personal approach, if it comes up, I will usually, you know, say that there are some tendencies that are suggestive of this, and if they're interested, we can talk about some more. But the behavioral techniques that we talked about, certainly people who are going to therapy in DBT or STEPS or some of the others, that's part of the education. They talk a lot about borderline personnel, and I think in general it does help for most people, not everybody, most people, to educate about it.
Well, Dr. Kreisman, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful hour. I found it particularly fascinating to listen to someone who's been working in the field all these years to really take us through how things have evolved. And I think it shows the test of time how your book, I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, is still one of the seminal works that people are still reading and referring to. So I thank you, and if we get any other questions, I hope we can forward them on to you.
Surely. Sure.
And some emails have already come in. Thank you. What a great hour this has been. So we thank you from all of our listeners tonight.
Thanks, Mary, and thanks, everybody, for listening tonight.
Thank you.
Right.
Take care. Bye-bye.